Good morning. Jerome Powell is at the Supreme Court today as his colleague challenges White House attempts to fire her. The Associated Press explains how it could decide his fate, too. A Wall Street Journal reporter takes us inside the courtroom in the case against an officer in the Uvalde school shooting. And in Davos, Trump says the U.S. won't use force to take Greenland, but could.
We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force, where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that.
It's Wednesday, January 21st. I'm Shmita Basu. This is Apple News Today. Today, Jerome Powell will watch on as the Supreme Court considers President Trump's attempted firing of Fed Governor Lisa Cook. The case centers on a concept laid out in the Federal Reserve Act, which says that Fed board governors can only be fired for cause. Chris Rugaber is an economics writer with the Associated Press, who explained how this has allowed the agency to retain its independence.
The idea behind the Fed is that it has some insulation, not complete insulation, but some insulation from political pressure, so it can do unpopular things like raise interest rates in order to push back on inflation, which most elected officials don't want to do because, you know, higher interest rates makes mortgages more expensive, car loans more expensive. And so it's hard for anyone who's facing election to want to do that.
The Trump administration has accused Cook of mortgage fraud and argued in court filings that that's a legitimate reason to remove her from her post. Cook and her attorneys deny that accusation and say that she was not afforded due process.
This is an unprecedented move by President Trump to remove a Fed governor. It's not happened in the Fed's 112-year history. So the argument is that the court should maintain the status quo while this case then plays out in the courts.
If the court rules against Cook, it could signal an opening for Trump to remove the Fed chair as well. Powell recently hit back against a threatened criminal indictment from the Trump administration relating to comments he made in Congress about renovations to Fed buildings.
You're seeing a sign of what the Trump administration might do if they are able to remove people for cause. They would then maybe use this building renovation, they would remove the chair, and they would possibly find reasons to fire other people. Some analysts say that the move against Powell made it more likely that Cook would win her case, at least temporarily, because it shows how far things might go if you allow the Trump administration to remove people for cause.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said yesterday that he didn't think it was right for Powell to be attending the Supreme Court arguments. He spoke with CNBC from Davos.
I actually think that's a mistake, because if you're trying not to politicize the Fed, for the Fed chair to be sitting there trying to put his thumb on the scale is a real mistake.
Powell has previously said that the Fed will not get involved in commenting and will abide by whatever the court decides. While his term as chair is set to end in May, Rugaber pointed out an interesting wrinkle that could impact the future of the Fed's relationship with the White House.
There's a separate term he has as a governor, a member of the 7-member governing board, and that goes until January 2028. He could remain on the board for that time, and then that would deny the Trump administration an opportunity to fill the seat. Most people expected that he was going to step down until this subpoena came out a little more than a week ago. Now the expectation, I mean, no one knows, but now it's seen as at least somewhat more likely that he may stay on the board.
Decision in the Cook case is expected by this summer. Today in Uvalde, Texas, an extraordinary trial is entering its final stages to decide whether a single police officer can be prosecuted for how they responded to a school shooting. Back in 2022, an 18-year-old gunman arrived at Robb Elementary School and opened fire, killing 2 teachers and 19 fourth graders. In the years since, federal and state reviews have been highly critical of the police operation, with the Justice Department concluding it was riddled with, quote, cascading failures. More than 370 officers responded that day, and it took nearly 80 minutes for a tactical team to kill the shooter. But Adrian Gonzalez, who arrived on campus moments before his colleagues, is one of only 2 men to be facing criminal charges.
Prosecutors are essentially arguing that he didn't act quickly enough when there was this gunman on campus.
Elizabeth Findell is a Texas-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal covering the trial.
The central question is whether a police officer has an affirmative duty to protect the public. Are they required to act? And that's interesting because it hasn't been tested very much, and there really aren't many other cases like this.
The indictment claims that witnesses alerted Gonzalez to the shooter's location and he heard the gunfire, but he failed to engage, distract, or delay the shooter, and he didn't follow his active shooter training. Here's the special prosecutor, Bill Turner, in his opening statement.
So why are we here? When a child is in danger and calls 911, we have the right to expect a response.
The prosecution is arguing he should have run towards the gunshot. That's what cops do. They follow threats and you run towards the gunshots and you figure out where they're coming from and you neutralize them.
Gonzalez has pled not guilty to 29 counts of child abandonment or endangerment. And his defense says he did take action by chasing who he thought was the gunman, then assisting other officers and helping evacuate kids from other classrooms.
The government wants to make it seem like he just sat there, you know. He didn't just sit there. He did what he could with what he knew at the time, and this was fluid and it was a dynamic situation.
Many of the victims' families have been watching the proceedings in the courtroom. Manuel Rizzo, whose 9-year-old nephew was killed in the shooting, told Texas Public Radio why he was there.
We're going to hope that the prosecution, the prosecutors, the district attorney, and the people that owe this to their constituents do their job. And they do a damn good job of it. But we want them to highlight every single opportunity Adrian had to protect the children and teachers and the survivors.
Findell told us that prosecutors have not accused Gonzalez of causing the deaths or injuries of the children, and they must prove his actions negligently caused harm. In attempting to prove his inaction was criminal, this case stands apart from most charges against police officers. She told us there is really only one other case that parallels this, which was the trial of an officer who was on duty in Parkland, Florida, when a gunman killed 17 students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in 2018. That officer was acquitted of felony child neglect. While some families of victims say they hope to see Gonzalez found guilty, Findell told us the focus on one individual following systemic failures hasn't satisfied everyone.
Multiple reports have shown that the response to the Uvalde shooting was a complete failure at pretty much every level involving numerous agencies. And so a lot of people have asked why this guy out of 370-some officers. Prosecutors haven't answered that completely directly, but I think the answer is likely because he was the first person on the scene, even if only by seconds.
The closing arguments will be heard today. Something kind of counterintuitive is happening in the American job market. Companies are increasingly looking toward an older workforce to fill its open roles. In fact, according to one recent analysis by a company that reviews employment trends, the average age for a new hire last year ticked up to 42 years old.
What is happening is that entry-level roles are kind of starting to look a lot more like management than they used to.
Taylor Telford is a Washington Post reporter, and she told us there are a couple of things going on that are making life difficult for Gen Zers. Many people who are employed already are staying on the job longer, some into their 60s and 70s. And then employers, betting on AI making jobs easier and more efficient, are increasingly looking for more seasoned resumes.
The kinds of things that we're now seeing more common in some of these entry-level roles are they're asking for skills that are a lot more like what we would typically see for somebody who's more experienced, who's had more time to learn how to do things like manage people and manage projects. And so what we're seeing is that actually older workers are really having an easier time in this market.
The data the Post examined showed that the share of workers 25 and younger has declined since 2022. Last year saw U.S. employers pretty dramatically pull back on hiring, which could typically pull in more younger, entry-level workers. That doesn't appear to be happening at the moment.
What's interesting right now is that the economy is doing really well, and we're still having all of these conditions where post-grads are, in some cases, spending 1 year, 2 years, 3 years applying to jobs without getting anything in the realm of what they studied.
Telford told us about Menasha Thomas, a 23-year-old who graduated from Barnard College in 2024 with a degree in urban planning.
She spent basically 14 months now applying to different jobs. She's done networking. She's spent a lifetime on LinkedIn, it feels like, to her, applying and also doing a lot of upskilling, trying to make herself more hireable with new certifications. And after all of that time, all that she has to show for it is a paid internship, which she is admittedly really grateful for. But it just goes to show that in this situation, folks are just having a really hard time breaking in.
On the other side of this equation is the people staying in their jobs until later in life and the forces pressing them to do that.
There's also the aspect of huge financial pressure that is definitely keeping retirement maybe more out of reach for a lot of people than they might have thought. Inflation has really driven up the cost of living in the past couple of years, especially the cost of stuff like housing and transportation and food. And so for a lot of people, they might have thought that they would have been ready to be out of the workforce at 65, but some of them are actually even unretiring in this environment. And in a lot of cases, they're rejoining the workforce because of that financial pressure.
And finally, a few other stories we're following. President Trump addressed the Davos summit this morning, demanding control of Greenland, but assuring European leaders that the United States would not use force to take the territory.
I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force. All the United States is asking for is a place called Greenland.
Though he also said in the address that if leaders did not acquiesce, quote, we will remember. He at one point referred to Greenland as part of North America and, quote, our territory. Yesterday at the summit, French President Emmanuel Macron criticized Trump's threats to impose tariffs on several European countries opposed to his Greenland takeover.
We do prefer respect to bullies. And we do prefer rule of law to brutality.
And Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney joined in what seemed to be a rebuke of Trump, though he never mentioned him by name, urging like-minded nations to stick together.
The middle powers must act together because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu.
Also this morning, the European Parliament suspended work on a U.S.-EU trade agreement in response to President Trump's tariff threats over Greenland. That means that the EU's plans to slash tariffs on a number of U.S. industrial products are now on hold. And Vice President J.D. Vance and his wife, Usha Vance, announced they are expecting their fourth child later this year, and it'll come with a historic distinction. Vance will be the first vice president known to have welcomed a child while in office. Vance and Trump have both spoken out about how Americans should have more children, though the New York Times notes how, 1 year into office, some of Trump's early pro-family proposals, like making IVF free and federal baby bonuses, have not materialized. The new baby Vance, like all babies born between 2025 and 2028 with a Social Security number, will be eligible for a so-called Trump account of $1,000 seeded by the government. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Men's Health explores America's nicotine boom and how, despite an attractive rebrand, long-term health consequences for consumers are just now starting to become clear. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.